First of all, I'd like to welcome you, particularly on this dreadful day. I mean, the weather's really awful today. Thank you very much for coming to Palazzo Falson. Now, these lectures have been organized together with the University of Malta, between Palazzo Falson and the University of Malta, particularly the History of Art Department. They are the first cycle of lectures we've organized, and the team that they are taking up is the medieval team, medieval art and architecture. We've had a very good response, and we're hoping now to extend it further in future. Now, the way we conceived sort of this idea was, first of all, to give young academics and researchers, young and emerging researchers, the possibility of presenting their research to the public. And secondly, we wanted it to be in a bit of an informal setting so that a discussion can ensue. So we do encourage some discussion after the lecture. As I said, the response has been good, so we want to extend it further eventually. And that's it, really. So thank you very much. I'll pass the word over to Professor Bohajar, head of the Department of History of Art.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Balzan. Well, when Francesca first approached me with this idea, I said, well, that's a very, very good idea indeed, especially since the lectures are concerned with primarily with the Middle Ages, with medieval Maltese, late medieval heritage, and the study of medieval art and architecture as one of the main foci of the history of our department, where there's a focus on Baroque art, but there's another focus on medieval art and architecture. And I'm very, very happy to tell you that the university is realizing the importance of studying medieval art and architecture. And for the first time, we have got a small but I think important research grant to focus on our medieval heritage. And that's a step in the right direction. Well, about today's lecture, well, Charlene Vella is the postgraduate student in the department who is focusing her attention on the Middle Ages, and she has carried out a good amount of research both in Malta and outside Malta. It's one of the merits of Charlene that she has traveled extensively in Sicily, the Calabria, the Apulia, and the Basilicata regions of South Italy. She has also been to North Africa, and therefore she can make comparisons between what we have in Malta and how we can relate them, how we can better contextualize them in the art and architecture of the central Mediterranean region during the long period of time that she's taking into cognizance, the period between 1091 and 1530. Last Friday, we had the first of a cycle of seminars at university in which our MA candidates are asked to give a little talk on aspects of their research. And Charlene gave a very stimulating lecture on the two Sicilo-Norman capitals that still survive in Malta. And her study has opened new possibilities, and I myself am finding it important to rethink several of the things that I had said about the Middle Ages. So it does work both ways. I mean, a lecturer lecturing is a process of learning, and this is what I find most stimulating.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, and good morning, everyone. As Professor Bahadur has said, my area of specialization is medieval Malta, and it is now nearing its completion, and I am looking forward to other projects which will start as soon as I finish. Due in the first place to its geographic location in the center of the Mediterranean and the result of cultural and social contacts with Islamic North Africa on the one hand and Greek and Latin Christianity on the other, the Maltese islands were caught at the crossroads of cultural cross-currents that were often conflicting, but due primarily to common geophysical realities, they sometimes complemented and enriched each other. This is particularly the case of architecture, which can at best be described as a synthesis of North African technical idiosyncrasies with its logical response to a harsh, treeless environment and a European sophistication. The scope of this lecture is to put the OG Arch in a proper art historical perspective. So I would like to begin with differentiating between the pointed arch, which is on the left, and the OG arch on the right, because the two are often confused. The term OG or keel arch refers to an arch that consists of two convex and two concave arcs that converge to form a cusp at its crown. As you can see in this image here, an OG can be constructed by using an equilateral triangle and a compass. And the result is this. Now, the Maltese examples are generally formed out of one lintel. Now, focusing on the pointed arch, which is much simpler and straightforward than the OG arch, the pointed arch is recurrent in both Western Romanesque and Gothic architecture and Islamic North African architecture. Pointed arches must have been used ubiquitously in late medieval Malta, as in fact was the case all over the central Mediterranean and much further beyond. Examples are numerous, and here I will mention some very well-known examples. This here is the Siculo-Norman Benedictine cloister at Monreale. You can see the pointed arches there. And another detail. This fountain here you might recognize. There's an imitation of it downstairs in the courtyard, which Golscher constructed himself. And here another example, another image of the pointed arches. Now moving to South Italy, there are significant examples in Puglia, particularly in Bari, which is this one here. This is Bari again, next to the Church of St. Nicholas. This is Trani, the cathedral. And Brindisi, this is the entrance to the walled city. Pointed arches also feature in France. And this example here is Amboise. You can see the pointed arch over there. The beautiful Fontenay Abbey, which is austere but still makes use of such a basic element of architecture. And this here is the Palais du Roi de Majorque, the Palace of the Kings of Majorca in Perpignan, which was founded by King Jaime of Aragon and which was the capital of Catalonia at the time. This is another image, shows the pointed arch in use at Perpignan. Now closer to Malta, Sicily, I wish to put particular emphasis on these pointed arches here. This is the Sala di Ruggiero and the Palazzo dei Normanni at Palermo. There you can see slightly a pointed arch there and another over there, these two. And again in Palermo, this is the bell tower of the Church of Santa Maria dell'Ammiraglio, which is also close to the Church of San Cataldo. You can see the pointed arch there. This is the Palazzo Santa Sofia, which is just across the road from Palazzo Falson, and it is a very significant example. It's a Sequifa passageway, which may incorporate, and the Palazzo may incorporate within it, one of the oldest surviving structures of Imdina, which may arguably date to the Norman period, that is the 12th, 13th centuries. The tall pointed profile of the Sikifa has characteristics that are essentially Sikolon Norman. Of greater interest, and perhaps more genuinely Norman, is the archway of Greek's Gate, also in Imdina. Now moving on to pointed arches in Imdina houses. These are examples. This example comes from Palazzo Falson. The entrance lobby. This is the refectory. You can see the pointed profile there. An image of the refectory, a clearer image. This is where the arch is. That's it over there. Another Imdina dwelling with the pointed arches. And again here. As you can see from this image taken from a book by Conrad Take and Richard England called Imdina, Citadel of Memory, you can see the use of the pointed arches of Palazzo Falson. I chose to show this image because you can't really see the facade in its entirety from the street elevation, from the street in front of it. So you can see the use of the pointed arches over here. Pointed arches in Gozo. This is the Gozo Citadel, and there's this passageway which makes use of pointed arches, and it's a roofed passageway. Pointed arches feature again on Palazzo Gattamarina. You can see the profile there, the pointed profile there. There is a popular misconception that associates the pointed arch with the Muslims, which must be dismissed. The pointed arch is in fact pre-Muslim and was used profusely in Western Europe. This goes to show that, as in the case of rubble construction, there is nothing essentially Islamic in the pointed arch. Its use transcended regional and cultural barriers in the long Middle Ages. Now, going back to the OG arch, just think of the first thing that comes to mind when you see this type of arch, and what you think the influence and where it originally, what vocabulary, visual language it speaks. Well, the OG arch is also popularly thought to be of North African origin. However, this is once more wrong. That the OG arch is not of North African origin can be proven by photographs of important Western European examples that I came across in the course of my research visits abroad. So, as a little side note now, I would like to state that the arches that established the service of the Gothic vault, these here, where the transverse ribs stemming from arches intersect, are known as ogives. The OG arch became popular in the later Gothic style known as the flamboyant style. Now, it is interesting to note here that the term OG may be an English corruption of the French word ogive. So, another Gothic connection with the OG. A little side note on the Gothic architecture in Malta, where mullioned windows apart, particularly this exceptional fine example in St. Peter's Street, the OG arches are perhaps the most important truly Gothic elements in Maltese architecture before the coming of the Knights in 1530. The Knights enhanced the Gothic architectural language by the introduction of the quadripartite vault. First example is in the Church of St. Anne at Fort St. Angelo, and for which there's no evidence for the use of the quadripartite vault prior to their arrival. Now, going back to the OGs. Several examples of the OG survive in Imdina. This example here is in Mesquita Street. The Maltese OGs seem to consist mainly of arch depressions that are carved in relief in a slanted, chamfered way out of individual limestone blocks that are used as lintels above doorways. This example here is the most easily accessible, which is why I chose to put this on first. And it has a width of circa 75 centimeters. This example here, you can see it over there, has roughly similar dimensions, and this is in Palazzo Falson, and it is in what is now the curator's office. Thank you, Francesca, for showing it to me. It was discovered only a few years ago when the Palazzo was being restored and renovated, and it has never been published. This is a detail of it, because you couldn't really see. Other OGs in Palazzo Falson include this one here. You can see it at the bottom there. So now this is at least one of four existing OGs in the Palazzo. I have my doubts whether this is original. It's probably a Captain Golscher interpolation. And there's another OG in the small collections room, which may be original more than the courtyard example. I have also been informed that in the same room was an opening over here, which linked the small collections room with the sitting room, which is right behind it, where the opening from the latter side was topped with an OG that incorporated the Rose of Rhodes motif. This is an indication of a late date. The Rose of Rhodes, as a matter of fact, features on post-1530 buildings and owes its name to the romantic belief, unfortunately not true, that it reached Malta with the Knights of St. John. Other examples of OGs in Palazzo Falso. This was when the palace was being restored, and this is how the OG looks now. It's on St. Xavier Street. It survives as a little window opening. However, again, its authenticity is questionable. The OGs on the first floor of Palazzo Falson are probably not older than the turn of the 16th century, when this part of the palazzo was largely rebuilt. Other structural modifications took place in 1530, when Grand Master Lilladam was accommodated here. Other examples of OGs in Medina. At least another three OGs survive within Casa Isabella in King Ferdinand Lane. And OGs which are similar, which are like this. This is a drawing taken from Perit Carmel Farrugia's dissertation on Medina dwellings. And the three OGs crown doorways, and they also have the Rose of Rhodes motif. Two of these OGs, as Perit Farrugia states, may be later interpolations, executed and modelled after the original one that may date to the late years of the late medieval period. I have also been informed about other interesting examples of OG arches that are extant in a private residence that formerly formed part of Palazzo Gatto Marina. Unfortunately, I have not yet gained access to this house. With regards to OGs, one must keep in mind that lintels are reutilizable features that may have been incorporated into their present locations at a later stage. Now let's try to trace the origins of the Maltese OG arch. This example is what is geographically closest to us, to Malta. It is on the 16th century Palazzo Borgio at Trapani. There are these OGs here. There's and then a series of mullioned windows on the second and third floors. This is a slightly more elaborated example that has little recessed decorations there. This is another image of the palazzo. You can see the OGs there. Again in Sicily, this time in Taormina, there's this OG that crowns the doorway in the courtyard of the 15th century palazzo, which had its origins as a Muslim tower. It is possible that the Maltese OG arches had a Sicilian origin. There are, nonetheless, other possibilities. Also, you have to know that the OG arch was widely diffused all over Western Europe, particularly in Catalonia and France. Somebody did mention that they look Spanish. I'm going to show you examples of OGs that I have encountered in France and Spain. I will start with Catalonia, with which Malta had an intimate political connection as a member of the Confederation of the Aragonese Catalan Crown. Some of the finest Catalan examples can be found in the Palais de Roi de Mallorca at Perpignan. This is the exterior of it. And this is an OG that can be seen in its interior. It's above a doorway, like the Maltese examples. Although Perpignan is now in the south of France, this palace remains a very important example of Catalan Aragonese architecture. Again in Perpignan, on a Gothic building, this is there are elaborate OGs visible on the Hotel de Ville in the historic center. You can see them there. Now, Catalonia. This is Girona, Spain. There is an OG over there, that window there. This building is to the right of the cathedral. If you've been to Girona, there's those steps that lead up to the cathedral, and this is on the right up those steps. Another example in Catalonia is Barcelona. This is the Museu Frederic Morris, and it is to the left of the cathedral this time. You can see it's in the Barigotic area. OG there. And yet another Catalonian example. This is on a partly demolished section of the monastery of Santa Maria of Poblet. It's over there. Now moving to France. These are some examples that I had the opportunity to study, particularly in Brittany and in Burgundy. So this is the exterior of the Church of Saint-Savoir. And there are numerous examples of OGs inside. There's this little one here. Another plain one here. Slightly more elaborate. And yet another example. Also in Dinan is this building. And there are OG arches over there on the top floor. Autun Cathedral, this is the exterior. And also on the exterior, if you walk around, you'll find several examples of OGs, including this one. A more elaborate example here. And on the interior, there's this example at the top of the staircase. And this is a detail of it. Fortunately, can't be seen very well. Close to the Autun Cathedral is the Musée Rollin. This is an image taken from the courtyard of the museum. And each and every window and doorway is topped by these OG arches. Now, the Musée Rollin was a building that was owned by Chancellor Nicolas Rollin. You can see him in this image here. This is a painting in the Louvre by Jean van Eyck. And you can see the lavishness in which he used to live, so that the OG arch features in one of his buildings must be quite significant. Again in France, this is Masson. It's a cathedral of Saint-Vincent, partly demolished, almost in ruins, really. It's a little museum inside, and there's an OG arch there in the center. This is a detail of it. And more examples of the OG arch. This is the Church of Saint-Nizier at Lyon. And now Vézelay. This is the road leading up to the pilgrimage church. Now, I saw two examples walking up. This is probably a modern example and an older example, more elaborate. Now that they feature in the road leading up must be significant. It must mean that they feature in the church, and in fact they do. This was a very important pilgrimage church. This is the tympanum, the very famous tympanum. And inside the church, you see the OG arch again, the detail of it. And yet again, in France, Fontenay Abbey. This building has two light windows, which also are topped by OG arches. Again at Cluny. On this tower, there are little arches, which are OG. And again, on a building close to this tower, you can see the OG there in the middle. And it again on another building in Cluny. Now, this is a particular example. It's Guimilio in Brittany, and in this parish close, which is a vernacular expression, a 17th century church. You can see the interior with the pointed arches as well. And there's an anachronistic OG arch. And another interesting example is this modern example at Aubray. So it shows the popularity of this OG. Now, moving back to Malta, particularly to Gozo. I don't know how many of you know about the late medieval cemetery that was discovered just outside the Castello, but 28 local soft limestone leisure stones were found, and two of them carry OG decorations. There's that one there, and that one in the middle there. So there's two out of the 28 leisure stones that have this OG arch. The leisure stones are today scattered between the Gozo Archaeology Museum, the Don Bosco Oratory, and the Gozo Public Library. So the two leisure stones with the OG arch are seemingly no longer preserved, and it is thanks to a drawing reproduced by Count G.A. Chantar in his 1772 Malta Illustrata of Vero Descrizione di Malta, Volume 1, that we know of their existence. It is significant that the OG arch makes its first known appearance in Malta on these two leisure stones. In my master's thesis, I will be focusing in depth on these leisure stones, which I studied with the assistance of Paul Williamson of the V&A Museum, Lawrence Butler, who is probably the most important authority on medieval tombstones in the UK, and Professor Danny Sandron from the Institut d'Art at the University of Paris, Paris-Cat-Sorbonne. All of them see a probable French 13th century connection in these leisure stones. I wish therefore to ask whether it might be possible to trace the origins of the OG arch in Malta to the Angevin period, which began in 1266 or 1268 and lasted to 1282. Or perhaps there might be a Catalonian connection, or both. As a concluding note, this lecture suggests that the OG arch was a common idiosyncrasy of Gothic architecture and was frequently used in Catalan and Angevin architecture. Its use in Malta provides us with another instance of European sophistication. It also goes to show that medieval Malta was not an artistic desert, as is often taught. My thesis will be further emphasizing this point.
Have you seen any drawings, arch passageways actually, which are perforated, not just recessed? What you've shown here, Malta is recessed.
The Casa Isabella ones are doorways. Okay. Casa Isabella. They are doorways. They are.
It's their part. It is the OG part of the lintel.
The OG is carved out of one full lintel.
About the arched passageway, the Zakifa, I think one of the most interesting things that have come out from Charlene's research is that we tend to call all arched passageways Zakifas, but there's a basic differs. You can elaborate on that, Charlie.
So, Professor Bahajar's publications and other publications tend to describe the Palazzo Santa Sofia passageway, for example, as a sekifa, a covered passageway. It is not wrong. However, when I went to Tunisia and I was asking about the sekifa, they showed me a sekifa in a private dwelling, and the Sekifa itself was what we term here the Mijlis, which is the reception room of the house. What they call this, the actual covered passageway in streets, is a sabbat. And we found a connection with the sabbat and Gozo in the citadel. Now, sabbat was also a surname, so we have to be careful not to imagine things too much. But that is the basic difference, that a covered passageway in a street, like the Gozo example, is a sabbat, not a sekifa.
The covered passages, very often you find in an alleyway, you go for more to the sabbat topology than to the sekifa topology. She has been discussing that with Professor Wettinger and
that's it. Is it like the one in the Palazzo Santa Sofia?
Similar, but you can find the arch passageway in various alleyways in Malta.
Exactly.
The most significant is in Victor Tower, Busawara.
It's the same. It's an arch passageway with a building cutting over it. And there's another example in Tarshin.
Yes. You can find them in the historic course of towns and villages. And
when you mentioned Sabbat being a surname in North Africa rather than... Is it present in Malta?
Not present, no. It's in Professor Wettinger's place names of the Maltese Islands. I don't think it's... No, it didn't survive, but... The thing is, this area on the Gozo Castello could refer to this family rather than to the actual architectural feature, so you can't exactly be sure. The Latinization of the Mdina started in Mdina in the city centres, the Gozo Castello and probably Fort St. Angelo, and then it spread out. There was a cultural backwater in the countryside, but not in Mdina.
Yes, that's very good. One of the mistakes I think that we often make is to regard Malta as a cultural, artistic backwater during the medieval period. That may be true of the countryside, but it was certainly not true of the civitas. I prefer calling Imdina the civitas in the medieval period. This is how the gentry referred to it, how the cathedral chapter referred to it, how the universitas referred to it. It is always the civitas. And well, there was very much an informed artistic patronage. The paper that Charlene has published in Melita Historica, in the last but one issue of Melita Historica on the Petronilla in 1370, a bell is commissioned from the most important foundry in Venice. And it's very significant. A foundry that produces bells for the cathedral at Verona that are commissioned by the Scala family, that produces bells for Dalmatia and for several other places, including
Malta. That is very significant.
And at the same time, you've got in the cathedral the Dormition panel, which must come from very early on in the Maltese Aragonese period. That is a very important example of Catalan Romanesque art, in which the Jewish, the Islamic, and the Western Romanesque, you know, come together, and Malta have a very important, which we very often overlook. In the beginning of the 15th century, when they commission a pala for the cathedral at Imdina, they go to the best available artist in Catalonia, to Luis Borrassà. And then there is the Messina connection, on which Charlene will be working, the intimate relationship between Malta and Antonello da Messina. Antonello da Messina's sister, who is married to a Maltese. And there are artist sons in the family who produce important paintings. Those who had the good fortune to visit the exhibition of Antonello da Messina at the Scuderia del Quirinale 2 or 3 years ago, the importance that was given to Petro and Antonio Saliba, who are the Antonello's nephew. They are Maltese, they are domiciled in Sicily, but they produce works. If you go to the Accademia in Venice, or the Galleria dell'Accademia, paintings there by Antonio de Saliba, and Charisa on the track, who work on this together, of a painting that may be very, very, very significant. And that's why I said I'm very happy with this research grant that the university has granted us.
I wanted to ask if you find this OG arch in Fort St. Angelo, where, if I'm correct, part of it belongs to the Angevin period.
Yes, it did live through the Angevin period. It's probably, very probably, pre-Angevin, Fort St. Angelo. But no, I have never seen the OG arch in Fort St. Angelo. But a lot of changes have taken place, so.
But then within Fort St. Angelo, in the chapel of St. Anne, the profile of the ribs of a vault that is pure Cicalonum. And in the same way that Charlene pointed out, we've got pure Cicalonum arch in the Palazzo Santa Sofia, arched passageway in the Greek's Gate, and in what may be the oldest surviving medieval room in Malta in Palazzo Santa Sofia. Yes, which I am sure
Farid Farooja will be discussing in his lecture, because he lived in that house, was born in this room, and therefore he knows it intimately.
It's becoming customary nowadays to tap the language, any language, okay, for any information which can give on any subject of cultural interest. For example, I remember reading some time ago in a book about Maltese architecture, the idea that since even the basic tools used by stonemasons in Malta, the names for these tools is mostly of Romance origin, that would mean that the natives are only capable of building Giren here, and the rest came from Europe, which is obviously manifestly not true, because I mean, in the language we have words like Orfa, Dweira, Setah, you know, Shorok, Kilep, Shulil, which obviously goes to show that the Maltese were able to build at least the Maltese traditional house, okay, for all called Fahab. Now, just as a matter of information, apart from the word Hneya, which is in itself of Semitic origin, in the dictionary nowadays only, okay, because it's been lost, but we have the name Hneya Hemeziya, which is actually a pointed arch, which etymologically the dictionaries try to latch it on to the verb Tehmes, Hemeziya, okay? It's a pointed arch. But also we had the word or verb Hiser, like a Hesri, for example. Hneya Tehser Ma'ohra, meaning it means interconnecting arches, okay? I mean, just as a point of information, on the Semitic side.
I should point out here that the Girna is not North African. You see it in Puglia and Sicily, but not in North Africa. So that connotation with the Girna and the Arab world is not correct either.
I believe though that maybe I'm wrong on this one, but the word Sifa itself is actually registered.
It's still used in Tunisia and Gozo.
Wattinger, I believe, has found the word Sifa in Malta.
Yes. Okay. Yes, in the documents. Yeah. It's published.
And Sifa is actually the standard North African house. Is entered through via a Sifa.
But is it a North African typology? Did the Romans not use the same introverted type of house?
But the world is an island, right? I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, but eventually you have to decide whether the case in Malta stops in an Islamic or Arabic context or goes further. With the OG, I'm sure you're right. I mean, it's probably of European, probably not later than the Angevins, but it's just an opinion.
You don't have to really ask about your thesis, really. But the ledgers, those from Gozo, are attracting very considerable importance.
Internationally.
Paul Williamson of the Victoria and Albert Museum will be having in Malta. I've invited him to Malta to lecture in my department in April, was absolutely fascinated by them. He thinks that he sees a French connection, he sees a 13th century connection. And we have my suggestion, Charlene also sent photographs of them to Rita Wood
Wood.
Instrumental in establishing contact, and she immediately said, well, go to Lawrence Battler, he's our great authority on medieval ledgers, and he too reads a French connection in them, and the same with Danny Sandron.
So three different professors saying the same thing.
The Institut d'Art, the head of Institut d'Art in the Rue Michelieu in Paris, the Institut d'Art is part of the Paris Quatre, Sorbonne, and so you have got these ideas. Well, so there are a lot of possibilities that are being opened up. A possible Crusader connection, which Rita Wood first suggested, and Moshe Barak in his book on Crusader art, Charlie was talking about last Friday at the seminar that we had at the University at the University of Malta, Crusader connection. How come? How can you account for a Crusader connection? Well, the Normans were very active in the Crusades. And therefore, there is this possibility which should be explored, possibilities that I had missed entirely in my art and architecture of the Middle Ages, and this is I find most stimulating. I'm rethinking many of my of the ideas. A telephone call from Tony Latterall only yesterday. How really Islamic is the roundel? How really Islamic is the roundel?
We had
already discussed it with Tony Latterall, but it's been. It's been at the back of his mind. It woke me up yesterday. I'm thinking about the roundel. Can we really call it Islamic? So there's a lot of things, a lot of question marks there, and that we're looking at.
Due to the lack of documents, most things are hypothetical. Traveling is important because you get to establish the similarities.
You've got to travel. You've got to travel. Traveling for the art historian is an essential requisite. You cannot learn art history by looking at pictures, by seeing videos or documentaries. You've got to see the actual thing, experience the actual thing. And it's very important then. That is the strength of the work that Charlene is carrying out, that she has had the opportunity, which she has very fully exploited, of traveling and of looking at things and of making very perceptive remarks about what she has seen. And so I'm very much looking forward to when you submit your thesis, Charlene.
Me too.
Thank you very much, Charlene. Well done.